This is the Bible Show. Welcome, folks, to another episode of the Bible Show. My name is Sam Kasten-Smith, and joining me is Will.
Hi, Sam.
And today, we are continuing our series on the miracles of Jesus, and we're going to do a couple of them today that center around fig trees. And the first one, we're going to see the calling of Nathanael under a fig tree, which is hints at a miracle. And then the other one is going to be Jesus cursing a fig tree. And so that's what's laid before us today.
And these don't sound interesting off the bat, because it's always like when you get to these parts, you're like, oh, these are kind of throwaways. I don't know what the fig tree has anything to do with. But I think once we work through it, it'll all start to click and we'll be like, oh, wow, this makes sense that like of all the text in the Bible that was not written in the book of John, like this seems like an odd story to make it. But here we are.
Yep. And like you said, these have profound significance as to why Jesus is doing this. Involving fig trees. And so we're going to jump right in. It's at the end of John chapter 1. So Jesus has just called Peter and Andrew and James and John. He's just had that encounter, which John really abbreviates. And it's in John where you find out that Andrew was actually a disciple of John the Baptist, saw Jesus, heard all the commotion, you know, and then it's like, hey, Peter, I think we found the Messiah. And one of the things that's interesting to me, this is just throwaway comment, but so the first four people that Jesus calls to himself, Andrew's going to be like number one on board, then Peter, then James, then John. So he's got these first four, and yet Jesus' inner circle is going to be Peter, James, and John.
Yeah, and Andrew kind of.
It makes you wonder, like, what happened to Andrew? Why didn't he make the cut for the inner circle? Because there's so many stories where Jesus does something only with Peter, James, and John. You know, the transfiguration, or, you know, when they separate in the Garden of Gethsemane, it's Peter, James, and John. That's his inner circle. But Andrew falls away. And the only way that I can make sense of that, this is totally off topic, is that Andrew had already had John the Baptist, which was much more of a legalistic, ascetic kind of thing. And he was looking for new wineskins that were able to receive something new. And maybe Andrew was a little bit more of the kind of rigid John the Baptist type.
That's interesting, yeah.
So maybe, total theoretical, but it's always been like, oh, poor Andrew.
Like, yeah, he's the first to come, and then you never, like.
Right, he doesn't make the cut. Like, he's not in the inner.
He brings Peter into it, and right? Like, Peter, and then Peter takes the top spot, and you're like, oh, come on.
Yeah, like, he should deserve something for that. But anyway, he makes the 12, but he doesn't make it into the inner three. So he's just discovered those four disciples. He's given Peter his new nickname, the Rock. And then you jump into chapter 43, and it's telling you about the calling of another couple of disciples. And this is where we find our story today. Verse 43 of John chapter 1, it says, "The next day, Jesus decided to go to Galilee. He found Philip and said to him, 'Follow me.' Now, Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. And Philip found Nathanael and said to him, 'We have found him of whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph.'" And so, like, Philip, it didn't take much urging. It's just to follow me and he's in, right? But then he comes to Nathanael. And Nathanael and John, he's called Nathanael. In the other Gospels, he'll be called Bartholomew.
Nice.
And Bartholomew is kind of like the last name.
Okay.
Bar means son of, and then Tolmai is the son of Tolmai. So put it together, it's Bartholomew in the English. But it's like when you come across Peter, sometimes he's Simon Bar Jonah. Jesus will refer to him as, it means Simon, son of Jonah or son of John. And so Bartholomew and Nathanael, same person. So he says, hey, we have found the Messiah, the one of whom Moses wrote, Jesus of Nazareth. And so Nathanael comes back with this really kind of cutting, barbed quip, and he says, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?"
Oof.
And so if you know where Nazareth is, it's not one of the coastal cities of Galilee. It's more inland, and it's really small. It's like podunk country. You know, this would be considered like the sticks back in first century Israel, and it's like, the Messiah is coming from Nazareth? Like, what in the world could that possibly be? Well, there's wordplay, I think, that's going on here. So if you jump over to Isaiah chapter 11, the Messiah is given a particular title. And it says this: there shall come forth a shoot from the stump of Jesse. In other words, Jesse is David's father, and that tree is now like the stump. He says, a branch from his roots shall bear fruit, and the spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the spirit of wisdom and understanding, the spirit of counsel and might, the spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. And his delight shall be in the fear of the Lord. He shall judge not by what his eyes see, or decide disputes by what his ears hear, but with righteousness he shall judge the poor, and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. He shall strike the earth with the rod of his mouth. And so all of this is talking about a Messiah who doesn't just see external appearances, but can see down to the heart. He comes to judge the world. But what is the title that he's given? He is called the branch. And what's interesting about that word branch is it has the very same root of Nazareth, which is, if you look at the Hebrew, it's netzer, is what the word for branch. And so Nazareth has that Nazareth, and that's where that comes from. And so it's buried in there's this word for the branch that's going to come forth and bring life out of what's been decimated, is the idea. And so can anything good come out of the branch, is kind of the hidden buried in the wordplay going on there. And so, well, yeah, actually the branch is where the Messiah will come from. And so, like, when you find the prophecy later on where it says, you know, that he's going to be a Nazarene, that the Messiah would be a Nazarene, you go back and you look through all the Old Testament, you won't find a prophecy that says that Jesus is going to come from Nazareth. And so that's always made scholars go like, well, what in the world? Like, this, it makes this claim, but there's no Old Testament prophecy that says that. But there is something that says that he'll be the branch, which holds that same root. And so he is the greater Nazareth. He's the Netzer. And so Philip says to him, like, oh, yeah, you don't believe that anything good can come out of Nazareth? Well, come and see. And so Jesus saw Nathanael coming toward him and said of him, and I want you to think about the things going on in his comment, because it's very pointed. He says, behold, an Israelite indeed. Now, who's the first person ever called Israel?
Is that Isaac?
No.
Jacob.
So Jacob's name means what?
Deceiver.
Deceiver. Right? So here he comes and he says, behold, an Israelite indeed. That's Jacob's changed name, one who wrestles with God and prevails. So behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom there is no, what's the next word?
Deceit.
And so he's saying, he's reminding you of Jacob, right? So Jacob is the deceiver whose name is changed to Israel. And now here Jesus comes, and his first words to Nathanael is, behold, a real Israelite, somebody who's from Jacob, in whom there is no deceit. Like, this guy, you know, has integrity, everything, but he's making you link Nathanael with Jacob right out of the gate. So hang on to that.
And that's a disarming comment to hear from Jesus.
Like, yeah, for sure.
First introduction, you're like, all right, what's going on here?
Right. So he's already coming with all of his spidey senses up. Like, is this guy a joke? Is he for real? And Nathanael said to him, how do you know me? Which is interesting. He's like, oh yeah, you really do know me. I'm that guy. And so Jesus answered him, before Philip called you, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you. Now, this rocks Nathanael to his very core, which, you know, we're left to our imagination what this means. But it says, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you. And Nathanael's immediate answer, it says, Nathanael answered him, Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel.
Wow.
Okay, that must have meant something
to him,
right? So, like, in your mind's eye, when you're imagining this, here you have Nathanael sitting under a fig tree. Jesus sees him, and now at this point later says, hey, I saw you when you were under the fig tree. And that meant so much to Nathanael that he's like, you're the Son of God. You're the King of Israel. You're the Messiah for sure. I know it now. I just mocked you in the last sentence, you know, being from Nazareth and all, but now I'm 100% certain you are the Messiah. What do you think had to have happened under that fig tree?
I don't know, because that's a real turn. I mean, to go from nothing good come out of Nazareth to you are the Son of God, just because, like, Jesus could just be observant. You know, it could just be like, oh, I saw that. Like, oh, I passed by a red car today. That didn't change my mind.
Right.
Like, if you told me I saw you in your car, I'd be like,
great.
Cool.
Right.
Kind of weird. That doesn't
mean anything.
Kind of weird, actually.
But there's something, when Jacob finally gets his name changed in the stories of Genesis, he'd been this guy that deceives people out of their promises and out of their blessings all along the way. Everybody always wants to kill him after he's had anything to do with them. And the Lord asks him his name, and he finally says, you know, I'm Jacob. He's honest about his identity. And God says, no, from now on, you're going to be called Israel, for you wrestled with God and prevailed. And so it's when Jacob gets honest with God in his confession, when in the wrestling match, that God changes his name. And I think when Jesus comes and he says, behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom there's no deceit. I think what he's saying is, just like Jacob got honest in his wrestling match and finally owned who he was, and he was named Israel, there's something about Jesus that when he sees Nathanael, it's like, okay, you just went through something like that. Now you're a true Israelite that's no longer hiding. You're no longer lying. You're being honest. And so my mind, now this is total conjecture because it's where my imagination goes. When he goes and he says, hey, I saw you under the fig tree, that meant Nathanael had to be doing something where he thought he was totally alone. Mm. He's under the fig tree. He's totally caught off guard that somebody else saw him.
Yeah.
And I think he's under that fig tree having it out with God. Whether it's God, you know, I'm in a wrestling match with you and I don't know what you're doing and I want your blessing and I don't, just like Jacob. And this is going on and this is going on and this is going on. And he's in this desperate wrestling match with God. And whenever you're in a desperate wrestling match with God, the question is always what? Like, is he hearing this?
Yeah.
Does he see me? Does he acknowledge the pain, the struggle, the everything else that I'm going through? And so, like, in my mind's eye, that's what I imagine Philip's doing underneath this fig tree and begging. You know, obviously, they're looking for a Messiah. They're hopeful. They want something. They're longing for something. And Jesus comes up and he's like, hey, I saw you under the fig tree. Do you believe? Now, all of a sudden, Nathanael's like, no way. Like, if no one was around, like, I checked. Like,
yeah,
you know, this was an embarrassing moment where I was really having it out with God. No one was there, so the only way you could possibly see me
is if
you're God. You have to be of a different order. You're the Son of God. Like, and that generates the response. You are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel. And then Jesus gives another statement to him that is drawing your mind toward Jacob again. So it says in verse 50, Jesus answered him, because I said to you, I saw you under the fig tree, do you believe? You will see greater things than these. Like, just if that was enough for you to believe, man, just
about to get wild
to see what you're in store for. And he said to him, truly, truly, I say to you, you will see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man.
See where you're going?
What is that?
Jacob's ladder.
That's Jacob's ladder, right? So Jacob is running away from home. He lays down. He sleeps with his head on the rock. And he's given this image of angels ascending and descending. This is Jacob. And the message to him was, God is actively involved in the affairs of man. Mm. Like, heaven cares about the earth. Heaven is engaged with the earth. You have to believe that, even though you normally don't see that. That is the reality. And Jesus is like, you're going to see that, Nathanael. Mm. You're going to see heaven invade. You're going to see crazy, miraculous stuff. You're going to see the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. And so then you jump to Revelation when John is laying out the vision. When you go to the very last chapters of the book of Revelation, notice how many times from like 17 to 21-ish, like if you're in those chapters, notice how many times you find angels ascending and angels descending, and everything is what he's promising right here. And so then comes the question, like, okay, what is significant about the fig tree?
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts on the angels ascending and descending?
I think it's just how gracious of Jesus, God, to see Nathanael in that moment. I mean, because like you said, that's what we all want. There's moments in life when you're duking out with God and it seems like you're just talking into the sky.
Yeah.
And to be able to, in that moment, to actually experience like, oh no, God hears me, and to be, you know, justified in that and to be confident in that. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the whole point of it. Like, as long as I know God is listening, then I'm going to be okay. Mm-hmm. As long as I know God hears and God has the affairs of man in order, then I'm going to be all right. It doesn't matter what my current gripe with God is. Mm-hmm. I'm just looking. It's like half the time when we're talking with other humans, right? We just want to be heard. We just want to be seen. We just want to know, like, oh, there's someone out there who cares enough to listen. And that's, I don't need fixing all the time. I just need to be able to be like, oh. And so for Nathaniel to be like, oh, no, God in flesh is saying, no, I saw you. And you're going to see greater. I don't even need the greater things part, as long as you see me now. But just the gift of even greater things is amazing.
Yeah. And that's the reality of so much of our time in faith. There are seasons where it's like, are you even paying attention?
Yeah.
Because, you know, even prayer sometimes feels like a fool's errand to me. Like, are you engaged? And that's where faith, and those moments where you absolutely know the nearness of God, like, you have to make withdrawals on God's past faithfulness.
Yeah.
And you have to remember, like, oh, he's done all of these things before, so I know that he hears me. I know that he's with me. Even though right now in all of my flesh and brokenness and self-absorption and entitlement and everything else, you know, I'm griping away and it's like, God, what are you doing? Yeah. What are you doing? You owe me better than this. And it's like, okay, remember, he's always been faithful. He's going to work it through this season as well, which he always does. But to have him stand before Nathaniel, who's just mocked him for coming from Nazareth, and to be like, I saw you. Well, if he sees Nathaniel, guess what? He's God. He sees you.
Yeah.
He sees you and you're crying out. He sees you under your fig tree. And that's where I think this gets really interesting in the text, because the fig tree was always associated with paradise and Messiah.
Okay.
Okay. So let's go there for a moment. Go back to Genesis 3, when Adam and Eve are like, you know what? We don't want to be under God. We want our own authority. We're going to become like God. We're going to make our own decision. We're going to rebel against God. They fall, and what happens?
They get kicked out of the garden.
They realize they're naked.
Oh, and they cover themselves.
They sew together
fig leaves,
right? So the only fruit tree that we know is in the garden, it's not an apple. It could have been
there. Are you sure? I'm just kidding.
It never says apple, but it does say fig, right?
Okay.
We know that there were fig trees in the Garden of Eden. Probably there were all kinds of other fruit trees. Could have been an apple, but like, could have been a watermelon.
Like, that would be different.
Wouldn't it be like if the fall came from a watermelon?
Out of a huge watermelon. Yeah. I gotta stop. I can't go down this.
But figs we know are there. And so figs are always associated with a place of paradise.
Okay.
So our school here is Bethany, right? Bethany, and it's two Hebrew words. It's the house of figs, and it's driven toward.
Is it really?
It really is.
No one's ever said that out loud.
So Bethany is where Jesus ascends into heaven. Bethany beyond the Jordan is one of the locations where he's going to be baptized. So like, Bethany is always associated with paradise because it's a place of figs. But then you get further down the road in this and listen to some of these scriptures. So Zechariah 3, are you ready? It's referring to this vision. It's, oh, Joshua. Now, whose name is Joshua?
Well, Jesus, Yeshua.
Yeah, Jesus's name is the same. It says, oh, Joshua, high priest, you and your friends who sit before you, for they are men who are assigned. Behold, I will bring my servant, the branch. There it is again. What is branch? Where does that come from?
Isaiah.
Isaiah. Nazareth. It's Netzer, and like where we get Nazareth. So this is in that passage. For behold, on the stone that I have set before Joshua, on a single stone with seven eyes, I will engrave its inscription, declares the Lord of hosts, and I will remove the iniquity of this land in a single day. So it's referring to a Joshua who's going to remove the iniquity, who's associated with the branch, the Netzer. And then listen to what it says. In that day, declares the Lord of hosts, every one of you will invite his neighbor to come under his vine and under his fig tree. And so the realization that the Messiah has come, that justice is coming, the branch has come, is when you are sitting at peace under your fig tree. Oh, Nathaniel, I saw you under your fig tree. Mm. Hint, hint. Yeah. Like that day has come. Or Micah 4. Now, Micah 4 is one that talks about the birth of Jesus, that he's going to be God-born flesh, that he's going to be born in Bethlehem. Just before you get those prophecies, Micah 4 says this. It's very famous. He says, "You shall judge between many peoples and shall decide disputes for strong nations far away. They shall," you'll have heard this before, "they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not lift up sword against nation, and neither shall they learn war anymore, but they shall sit every man under his vine and under his fig tree." Okay, there's another one. So Jeremiah 8, referring to the coming of the Messiah, says, "They have healed the wound of my people lightly, saying, 'Peace, peace,' this wicked generation, when there is no peace. Were they ashamed when they committed the abomination? No, they weren't ashamed. They did not know how to blush. Therefore, they fall among the fallen, and when I punish them, they shall be overthrown. When I would gather them, declares the Lord, there are no grapes on the vine, nor figs on the fig tree." So this idea, when there's figs on the fig tree, people are right with God. When there's no figs on the fig tree,
no bueno.
No bueno, right? When the messianic reign comes, people are sitting under their fig tree. And so when Jesus comes and finds Nathanael and he points out, "Hey, I saw you. Where were you sitting? You were sitting under your fig tree." Wait a minute. Yeah, I was. And that is the fulfillment of Zechariah and Micah and Jeremiah. And it's a sign that the messianic reign has come. So all of these things coming together, the branch, the fig tree, all of that is screaming, the Messiah's here.
Yeah, because the fig tree seems like a throwaway line. Unless you know all of that, you're just like, all right, Nathanael could have been under any tree. It's weird that John, of all details, decides like, oh, it was a fig tree. And for us, it's like, all right.
Right.
Thanks.
And that is going to be, like, that would have been colloquial back in the day, like, oh, under the fig tree. Everybody has under the fig tree. That means that we are in a state of extreme blessing. Like, everything is going right. You know, you're under your vine and you're under your own fig tree. That means the land is abundant. There's fruit growing. You have your own land. You have your own, you know, prosperity. That was the idea.
And for them even just sitting under a tree, I mean, that's their restful place. I mean,
right.
It's sunny. It's Israel. So like, if you're trying to find rest, if you're trying to go anywhere that's enjoyable, you're not going into your house because then it's just, there's no air conditioning. Yeah. That just locked up air. So then you're like, oh no, the fig tree is where you find rest.
And so think about all of that that's brought together. Jesus is from Nazareth, the Netzer, the branch. He comes and he identifies Nathanael as being an Israelite in whom there is no deceit, without question, pointing to that conversion moment for Jacob, when he had just before that seen this ladder up and down from heaven where the angels are ascending and descending, and he's under the fig tree. And there are so many different nods toward the fulfillment of prophecy and the promise and the Messiah that are all together there, that it leads Nathanael to go, "You're the Son of God."
Here's everything.
This intersection and your supernatural ability to have seen me when no one was looking, you are the Messiah. And so, but that's not the last time that you will see the fig tree.
And that's not a miracle, or is it?
It's a miracle to see somebody who didn't know. So Nathanael certainly saw it as a miracle. It's not like he said, "Okay, rise up and walk or receive sight."
I see what
you
said. Now, it is one technically.
But this shows that he has divine
supernatural
omniscience.
Yeah.
He knows things that he should not be able to know. He's beyond human. And so then the second one is when he curses the fig tree in Matthew 21, which is one of the weirder miracles, right? So this gets back to the test. Like, when I was going through the different miracles, and we start with the premise that Jesus never performs a miracle as a parlor trick. He never does it self-serving. It's always to teach something. It's always to advance the gospel or the kingdom. This miracle feels like Jesus is having a temper tantrum because he's hungry.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, what in the world do you do with that? And so we're in Matthew chapter 21, verse 18. It says, in the morning, as he's returning, so he's just, the triumphal entry is just happened. He's in the last week of his life. He's confronting the religious leaders.
He works up an appetite cleansing the temple. You're gonna wonder why he's hungry, but then you're like, he threw some tables. So
he's going through a lot right now. Like, this is ramping up really, really rapidly. And so in the morning, as he's returning to the city, so this would have been the Monday after the triumphal entry, he became hungry. And seeing a fig tree by the wayside, well, that's a good sign. Like, we got fig trees, and that means abundance, right? This is great. Seeing a fig tree by the wayside, he went up to it and found nothing on it, but only leaves. And he said to it, "May no fruit ever come from you again." And the fig tree withered at once. What do you do with that, Will?
Nothing yet. I'm just waiting for something.
All right. So to get context of what's going on here, let's go on, because Jesus isn't finished with this miracle yet. It says, when the disciples saw it, they marveled, saying, how did the fig tree wither at once? And this is one of the miracles that's kind of stunning, because it's like usually Jesus brings life and abundance and fruitfulness.
It seems like an anti-miracle almost.
Right? Like, this is, it just dies and withers all at once. Like, wow, that's not usually what happens when Jesus gets involved with something. And so it says, they said, how did the fig tree wither at once? And Jesus answered them, truly I say to you, if you have faith and do not doubt, you will not only do what has been done to the fig tree, but even if you say to this mountain, be taken up and be thrown into the sea, it will happen. And whatever you ask in prayer, you will receive if you have faith. And then it goes on. Then he continues his ministry. But what I want you to focus on here, he comes up to this tree. What's in the background? In the morning, as he's returning to the city, so he's looking at the Temple Mount, he's looking at all the beautiful buildings and everything that Herod had constructed, and he comes up on this tree, and he's like, oh, I'm so hungry. I'm so looking forward to the fruitfulness of this tree, which from a distance looks amazing, and it looks really, really healthy, right? And so then he goes and examines it, and what does he find?
Nothing.
Nothing but leaves.
It's dead.
From a distance, it looks amazing. You get up close and you're looking for fruit, nothing there. And so then the disciples are like, how does this happen? And what does Jesus say? He takes them on a lesson of faith. Hmm. Now, let's not miss that. He says, if you have faith and do not doubt, you'll not only be able to do to the fig tree what I did, but even if you say to this mountain, what mountain?
The Temple Mount.
The Temple Mount. What does the Temple Mount represent?
Everything to the Jewish faith.
Everything to the Jewish faith. That's where you go to make atonement for your sins. That's where you go to the priest for cleansing. That's where you go. All of the law finds its intersection at the temple, right? Mm-hmm. And he's saying, if you have faith, you can take that temple and all of its systems and now throw it into the sea, which is the emblem of death and judgment. It doesn't matter anymore. What is he teaching with this miracle?
By his sacrifice, all of that's going to be null and void.
That's right.
No longer will they need that. If they have faith in Jesus, that all goes away.
And so everything that the temple offers to you, everything the temple offers to you is now available to you merely by faith. You don't need it anymore. The whole mountain, you can get rid of it. You don't have to come and grovel. You don't have to slaughter the animal. You don't have to go to the priest. You don't have to dot, 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 dot. All of this religiosity and the legal codes and the ceremonial law and all of that stuff is now rendered utterly worthless. You can throw it away. But also with that is he is giving an indictment. He is describing a symbol of what the temple actually is. Because later on, when they're leaving the temple in Matthew 24, listen to this. It says, Jesus left the temple and was going away when his disciples came to him to point out the buildings of the temple. And he answered them, you see all these, do you not? Truly I say to you, there will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down. So they're like, oh my goodness, look at how beautiful the city is. Look at the beauty of the temple and look at the beauty of the buildings. And all of that to him is a fig tree with really impressive leaves, but and yet there's no fruit at all. It is a wicked city that kills and stones the prophets. It is a self-righteous, legalistic city. And from the outside, remember, this is Jesus's constant critique of the Pharisees and the religious leaders. On the outside, you look really impressive.
Yeah.
Like, oh my goodness, look at the buildings. Look at the robes. Look at the tassels. Look at all the adornments. Outside, you look great. Inside, what does he say?
You're whitewashed tombs. You're dead inside.
That's right. You're filled with dead men's bones. Like, you care about the outside of the cup, but inside is just disgusting. And so that's the fig tree. He's not referring to a tree. It's not like Jesus comes to a tree and is like, I want figs, and I'm upset that there's no figs, and so he curses a tree. He's making this a teaching moment of the judgment that he's going to bring on the temple, which, remember what the temple is always supposed to represent? It's supposed to represent Eden. It represents Eden in that it faces east. It's got the cherubim on the doors that keep you from coming into the presence of God. It was to be a reminder of Eden. And what do we know is in Eden? Figs. And yet this is a paradise that's utterly empty. It is, there's no fruit there. It is hollow. And so when Jesus comes and says, I'm cursing this fig tree, the reality is he's looking right past the fig tree and he's looking at the temple and the city of Jerusalem. And he's saying, you are beautiful on the outside. You got all the leaves, but you are disgusting. There is no fruit in you. And you, just like he says, by faith, you can say to the mountain, pick yourself up and throw yourself into the sea. What does he say in Matthew 24? Every stone is going to be thrown down. And so, like, that's the point of the miracle, is it is a very, very stark warning against self-righteous religiosity, the temple structure, and how corrupt that had become. It was fruitless. There was no fruit. And in so many of Jesus's parables, they're about fruitfulness, right? Yeah. He's not finding any in Jerusalem.
And it makes this passage make a lot more sense, because this is a passage that's abused a lot.
Oh, my goodness.
Because people come to it, and they're not thinking, oh, that the mountains, the temple mount. They're thinking, oh, no, this mountain that I'm in the face of, this obstacle in my life, this hardship, this suffering, oh, this is my mountain. If I just pray long enough, I just pray hard enough, and I have enough faith, then God will take this away. I mean, it's a prosperity gospel oftentimes used. That, yeah. Like, and then people come to you and say, oh, well, Sam, that mountain that's in your life, like, are you not praying hard enough? Do you not have enough faith? Or are you not going to God? Because he hasn't removed this, so this has to be on you.
Yeah, and it makes it, like you said, it's totally prosperity gospel. Now, all the challenges that are in your life, glory will overcome.
Of course.
But this becomes like, if you just, because the way that Jesus phrases it is, if you have faith, you can do away with this mountain, right? Mm-hmm. Well, that is absolutely true when you're talking about the Temple Mount. Yeah. All of that religiosity and, oh, you got to keep the sacrificial stuff and blah, 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 all that's gone. Faith nullifies all of that for you because Jesus fulfilled it. If you have faith in Jesus, you don't need the temple stuff anymore. Mm-hmm. But then if you just generalize that to where you're like, hey, believe strong enough and this mountain of cancer, you know, will go away. Well, what that does is it puts this unbelievably unnecessary and unbiblical pressure that if, like, I have cancer because my faith isn't strong enough. You know, my mom's not being healed because my faith isn't strong enough. Because Jesus said, you know, if I just believe strong enough, I could say to the mountain, you know. And that's not what he is getting at here.
Yeah.
You know, that is not at all what he's pushing. But that's not to say that faith doesn't overcome a lot.
Yeah.
In the ultimate scheme of things, you do have the promise that death itself will be overthrown by faith. Mm-hmm. But in the immediate, when people abuse this passage like you're talking about, to say if you believe strong enough, you can have anything. You know, the world will just bend to you because, you know, God's the cosmic lottery and, you know, he's just going to make everything come your way. Like, that's an abuse of this passage.
And that's the tension that we have to live in as Christians, because we do believe that when you pray for people, oftentimes God will heal them. If he chooses to, he will.
Yeah.
And so we're not, you know, on a billboard saying, oh, don't pray for healing or don't
pray harder.
Yeah. Just keep going, but don't feel the burden that, like, oh, this rests on me. No, like, God's the healer, not you.
Mm-hmm. And he's the one who knows everything. And it's like if the old line, if you knew everything God knows, you would be grateful that he answers your prayers exactly as he does.
Yeah.
Like, he has a better plan. He knows better things. And by the way, when he is making that metaphor of the temple being the fig tree, covered by leaves, what does that immediately take you to? Covering shame and guilt and everything else with fig leaves. It's the fall. So it's like you guys are running around like you're covering up your shame by pretending that you've got it together and your religiosity and your chants and your whatever. Like, that's all just fig leaves behind it. You're still broken. You're still messy. You're seeking a covering, and that ain't it. That is just not it. And that's been the state of humanity ever since the fall has been, I don't measure up. I need a covering. And he's saying all of the religiosity of Jerusalem with the self-righteous attitude is not bringing you any closer to God. It's not doing anything for shame. It's just covering it up. And there's no fruit. There's no authentic fruit underneath it. He's comparing, which is funny, the temple and the Temple Mount to a fallen Adam and Eve.
And doesn't, in that story about the fall, doesn't God then have to slaughter an animal to give them a real covering for their bodies?
Yeah.
So even that's saying, like, even for Adam and Eve, like, that didn't work. Like, something needed to die in order for you actually to be covered.
Yeah. And he, being the Lamb of God, is going to be the one who dies to give us a covering. And there's another, and this might be a little bit too much to try to throw in here, but we're doing it anyway. There's another passage that's like this, you know, where Jesus says, if you had faith the size of a mustard seed, you could say to the mountain, pick yourself up and throw yourself into the sea. And Luke 17, verse 3 to 6, he says something very similar to that. And I want you to pick up on what this is. So it says, the Lord said, if you had faith like a grain of mustard seed, you could say to this mulberry tree, be uprooted and planted into the sea, and it would obey you. And what is that about? Does that mean, like, should we go try that? Because I remember when I was fresh in faith thinking, like, okay, if, you know, Peter had faith in Jesus, and so when he got out of the boat, he could walk on water so long as his faith was in Jesus.
Yeah.
So I stand at the edge of my pool, and I think, okay, I believe in Jesus, and I take a step, and 100 times out of 100, bloop, you know, like, I go straight to the bottom. But it's like, okay, well, why didn't my faith work? Because that wasn't the point of that miracle. Jesus isn't calling on believers to get out of the boating industry and just walk on the seas. Like, and the same is true here. We have to understand what he means with this particular message. If you had faith like a grain of mustard seed, you could say to this mulberry tree. Have you ever heard of a mulberry tree?
I actually just Google imaged it because I've never heard of one. It's a nice looking tree.
Yeah.
Pretty big.
Nice looking tree.
Solid, looks good.
So here we're coming up against another tree. But it should make us, as students of the word, go, what is a mulberry tree? And why does this matter to Jesus in first century Israel? But he says, be uprooted and planted in the sea, and it would obey you. Now, so here's something. There's a poet who lives at the same time that Jesus lives. The guy's name is Ovid. He's born in 43 BC, and he's going to live to 17 AD. So at the height of his popularity as a poet in Roman society is Jesus' childhood. When he's going to school, he's going to be hearing about Ovid. Well, he writes a poem that Shakespeare totally ripped off. And with Romeo and Juliet, like, that is not original at all. He totally ripped it off of Ovid.
Wow.
And so this poem was called Pyramus and Thisbe. And listen to what happens at the conclusion of that story. So here you have this forbidden love affair, sound familiar, where, you know, everybody hates that they're together. The families don't want them to be together and everything else. And so at the end of that, you have the woman who goes to the place where she's going to meet him. I'm probably going to butcher this a little bit, but a lion comes. And so she runs away, and the lion grabs her shawl or clothing or something. And it, you know, starts chewing it up, and blood from the lion's mouth is all there, to where when the man Pyramus gets there and he sees the thing all mangled up, he thinks, oh no, she's died. So guess what he does?
Kills himself.
And then she comes back and finds him dead and all the stuff going on. And this is what she says. Listen to both of our prayers. This, she's praying to the gods. Listen to both of our prayers. Do not begrudge us whom death has joined, lying at last together in the same tomb. And you, O tree, now shading the body of one, and very soon to shadow the bodies of two, keep in remembrance always the sign of our death, the dark and mournful color. And she spoke, and fitting the sword point at her breast, fell forward on the blade. So I guess it was him who died. She came and found it. So now she's killing herself. I got him backwards. She spoke, and fitting the sword point at her breast, fell forward on the blade, still warm and reeking with her lover's blood. Her prayers touched the gods, for the mulberry fruit still reddens at its ripeness. And so, in first century, what's a mulberry tree represent?
Death.
Death. But it's the death of somebody who is in mourning over the loss of their spouse, right? Specifically. And so now here you have Jesus coming. Who's Jesus to us?
The bridegroom.
He's the bridegroom. And he comes and he says, if you have faith, you can say to this mulberry tree, which represents what?
Death.
The loss of my bridegroom. Okay?
Yeah.
The bridegroom lost in death. You can say to this mulberry tree that's all representative of the blood and the loss of the bridegroom, get up, get out of the way, be thrown into the picture of judgment and the sea. And what is that? Faith overcomes
death
itself. And so in those two stories, you know, the fig tree withering and everything else, it's saying, man, by faith alone, you can say to all the religiosity and all the law and everything that just heaps shame and guilt on you, get out of my way. Like, you're done. By faith in Christ, that is rendered null and void. It's out of your way. Now, the next time Jesus says something similar to that, it's a mulberry tree, which right at that time in pop culture is going to be, you know, super famous as this image of death, where a bride who has lost her lover is now taking her own life in despair. And he's like, hold on a minute. No. That's not how the story ends. I'm not dead. Like, you can say by faith to that mulberry tree, symbolizing death and the loss of your bridegroom, get out of the way. You're done. You have no role here anymore. And throw that thing by faith into the sea. Now, we've lost our categories to when we hear mulberry tree, to go, oh, yeah, Ovid. You know, nobody thinks that. I had to research mulberry tree and came across this, and I was like, whoa, that's totally what it means. The mulberry tree is reddens with the image of blood. It's death. Faith does away with death.
It's amazing.
So all of those coming together in miracles, like, it's not just Jesus coming and saying, hey, Nathanael, I saw you under a fig tree. No, that fig tree has tremendous significance. Like, the Messiah was going to come and put everyone under the fig tree to bring them to paradise, to fulfill all the scriptures. He is, you know, the one who comes from Nazareth, the great branch. Like, there's so much going on there. And what he's telling us is, like Jacob, you will be transformed from the shameful ones of deceit, made into true Israelites that will see heaven come down and invade. Because that's not just Nathaniel's story. That's our story. Yeah. We serve a God who hears us. Then you jump to the New Testament, and he starts cursing fig trees. But they're false fig trees. They're empty fig trees that don't bear fruit, that are not prosperity. They're not blessing. It's all just leaves. And he's saying, No. That system that only covers you up but doesn't produce real fruit in you, like the temple system and all the religiosity, that you can mask it all, but you're still broken in a mess inside. There's no fruit inside. Throw that thing in the sea. The mulberry tree, death itself, throw that into the sea. And so when Jesus is speaking and performing these miracles and speaking of the miraculous power of faith in our life, we're to walk away from that, not just seeing Jesus as, well, you know, that was cool. You know, he read Nathaniel's mind. Great. That's powerful. Or, yeah, he made a fig tree die. No, he is preaching powerful gospel and these miracles. Amen.
Amen.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us on another episode of The Bible Show. Join us next week as we go into another miracle of Jesus. God bless. Thanks for listening to The Bible Show. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to like and subscribe and leave a kind review to help us in the world of tech algorithms. Also, feel free to share with a friend. We'll see you next week with another episode of The Bible Show.